Welcome to the Mayo Clinic Ophthalmology Podcast on all things ophthalmology brought to you by Mayo Clinic. I'm your host, Dr. Andrea Tooley.
And I'm Dr. Eric Bothan. We're here to bring you the latest and greatest in ophthalmology, medicine, and more. In this episode, we are joined again by Dr. Amir Khan, a cataract surgeon here at the Mayo Clinic. Last time he was here, we talked about a number of administrative roles and juggling your practice. Today, we're going to talk about some Journal Club articles, the first of which being Ophthalmology Workforce Projections in the United States, 2020 to 35, which was recently published in Ophthalmology Journal. And the second one is Endophthalmitis Rates and Risk Factors Following Intraocular Surgeries in the Medicare Population from 2016 to 19, recently published in the British Journal of Ophthalmology.
Dr. Amir Khan is a cataract surgeon and comprehensive ophthalmologist here at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Dr. Khan is chair of the Enterprise Equipment Committee and Clinical Equipment Subcommittee, as well as vice chair for the Medical Device Oversight Committee. He also serves as one of 12 representatives for the steering committee for Epic's Kaleidoscope. Dr. Khan is a past Mayo Clinic Residency Program Director, is currently the Medical Student Education Director for the Ophthalmology Department. We're so happy to have him here today for our Journal Club. Welcome, Dr. Khan.
Well, thank you, Andrew and Eric, and thank you for having me here. And it looks like today we're going to talk about the stuff that I do in the other 50% of my time.
Exactly. When we're thinking through different articles, and we have certainly plenty of articles we could talk about your specialty in cataract, but talking about endophthalmitis rates, getting into quality, getting into decisions and how we manage care, getting into equipment in some ways, and certainly your longevity in terms of teaching and being involved in program development pieces. Shortage of ophthalmologists in the workplace. It's just you're the perfect fit to say,
yes.
You wear administrative hats and eye care hats, and we're excited to break apart a couple articles with you.
Oh, that's great. Looking forward to doing that.
I selected both of these articles with Eric. They were both highlighted in iNet, and I love the AAO iNet where they have the roundup of articles mm-hmm. each month from some of the main ophthalmology journals. And I saw the endophthalmitis rate one. You're a cataract surgeon. It's a feared complication. I thought it'd be good to just touch base some of the publications and the data that we think about when we're talking about endophthalmitis. The data are old. We have these rates that we think about that differ across the globe. Eric, you and I were just talking about infection rates overseas versus here. And so let's talk about this article from BJO, Endophthalmitis Rates and Risk Factors Following Intraocular Surgeries in the Medicare Population from 2016 to 2019. So really recent data, kind of what you thought about it, if you want to give us maybe a little overview or kind of big take homes, and then we'll go through it a little bit more in depth.
Yeah, you know, I thought it was an interesting article because it kind of lumped together a lot of different procedures.
Mm-hmm.
That makes it interesting, but sometimes I think the overall number is less meaningful than when you start lumping in different procedures. I think what's nice is it shows that there's kind of an order of procedures, you know, and it kind of highlights the different rates of endophthalmitis amongst the different procedures. I was looking to see if they were injecting antibiotics at the end of the cases in these articles.
Yeah.
Did you see if they? I didn't see that they were.
I couldn't find anything about intracameral antibiotics.
Exactly, which I thought for an article that's coming out recently,
mm-hmm.
that misleads the data a little bit because I think current practice, or I'll just speak for our practice here at the Mayo Clinic, is it's for cataract surgery, but just about everybody gets intracameral antibiotics. And I know in a lot of the community practices as well, that's the standard given today is intracameral antibiotics at the end of the surgery. So I thought that would be an area that would be good to be addressed.
Dive into more. Yeah. You know, I think with the Medicare claims data, they're using. Exactly.
Details.
Yep. So we're limited in terms of the details for surgical technique. But the benefit is that the numbers of patients that can be included in the study are huge. So you'd think that those little details would shake out. And like you said, we still do discover kind of an order of higher risk surgeries versus lower risk surgeries. What I want to talk about this in a little bit, but one thing that really stuck out to me was the lumping of the cornea transplants, because a PK in my mind is totally different than a DMEC. And so to put them all together into one category, I thought was interesting, but also makes me wonder, because I would assume that the risk of endophthalmitis in a PK is way higher than the risk of endophthalmitis in a DMEC, but all we get is one big category, corneal transplant.
Yeah. Yep. Well, before we could dive in then that, let's just give people that maybe don't have the article in front of them. So there were some almost 10 million intraocular surgeries in this Medicare database between 2016 and 19, which again speaks to
Dr. Khan, your comment about the use of intracameral, because I, you know, that was in a phase where there's been an uptick in the use of them. So, and they looked at a variety of intraocular surgeries, including retina, glaucoma, cataract, intraocular, and divvied out. So the lowest, correct me if I'm wrong, was 0.09% was the cataract.
Correct.
Well, 0.08 or, no, I think 0.09 was the cumulative.
Yep.
Cataract is 0.08.
Okay.
So what that tells me is that probably a huge chunk of the cases in this study
I think 80% of the cases were cataracts.
Were cataract.
Mm-hmm. Because it's a very similar rate between the cataract and the overall.
And then it went on to list endophthalmitis rate by surgery, for those of you that aren't listening, is 0.43% for corneal transplant, 0.36 for secondary intraocular lenses, 0.24% for retina, 0.16 for glaucoma, and then again 0.11 for cataract surgery with other combined procedures. So breaking down, they group them, and as was just being shared, within these groups, there are differences. I mean, there's a difference between a glaucoma bleb and a MIGS, which is also in here.
Yes.
There's a difference between one type of corneal surgery and another that as you divvy out, some of these make sense. All right, this is a corneal transplant with a huge wound and lots of exposed sutures is different than a short little cataract surgery in and out and with a fresh lens. So in that regard, I think some of them jumped out. Were there any that you in particular reading were surprised at?
One of my take-homes, regardless of the procedure, relatively speaking, the percent of endophthalmitis is low.
Yes.
I mean, we're basically talking low and lower is how we're comparing things with these numbers. And because of that low number, I think that's where you really need the power of having almost 10 million cases to try to pick up any differences between them.
Great point.
One thing that I thought was interesting was the vitrectomy data. Some of the vitrectomies were probably for endophthalmitis, and so that's why they were excluded, because then it's double dipping. Is that what happened?
Yeah, sure. So I mean, I think what they're trying to capture here in this data is endophthalmitis that it was acquired for the first time after a given procedure. Certainly, you can have a cataract that's a sequela of endophthalmitis, or a retinal procedure that's occurring after the development of endophthalmitis. I thought that's why, as I read it, they were trying to tease out a naive case, fresh eye, you do a procedure, what's the immediate postoperative endophthalmitis risk?
Yeah, see, I read it as, okay, so, you know, your cataract patient comes in LP. Let's say they get a vitrectomy. The way it's coded is going to be vitrectomy. And they couldn't necessarily separate that out.
Yeah.
From someone who has, let's say, a vitrectomy with macular hole repair.
Mm-hmm.
What I read this is that they felt they couldn't necessarily separate out those two groups just looking at that data, and that they would inadvertently include some that had a vitrectomy as a treatment for endophthalmitis. Mm-hmm.
Even though they still had an exclusion criteria for no surgery 6 weeks prior. I think one of the exclusion criteria was you couldn't have had surgery 6 weeks leading up to it, but you'd think that that would exclude had any intraocular surgery on the same or unspecified eye 42 days before. You would think those should have been excluded. That's where it got a little dicey to me.
Yeah, so I read that as two separate cases. Mm-hmm. If there were two separate cases 42 days apart or shorter, then that patient was eliminated, because the question is the complication potentially related to the first surgery versus the second?
Right.
Yep.
Why do we think men have higher risk of endophthalmitis?
I don't know. We don't use antibiotic drops.
Is it a drop compiler?
We don't believe in medicine. Just some of the first things.
When's
that
the last time you showered a mirror?
Yeah, exactly. That's just some of the first things that came to my mind.
I wonder, is it a blepharitis thing? Is it just a drop compliance thing? Are women much more meticulous about their hygiene or medication use? Is that what it is?
You said it.
I didn't say it. I'm asking.
Yeah, no, I honestly don't know. I honestly don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the drivers, as you're speaking to, when they looked at analysis, the drivers of higher rates separate from the case performed was older age, and they grouped greater than 85 compared to 65 to 70, male sex, and then also other comorbidities on their index. So, yeah.
Yeah,
The one that perked interest was
I mean, for other comorbidities, you know, you wonder about, you know, immune status and other things like that, too. Because I really don't believe that our cases are completely sterile at the end of surgery? If we're at a culture, they're not completely sterile.
No, there's flora all over the right. lids and the lashes that you just can't completely control for.
So I think that's where being immunocompetent or having a weakened immune system may play into this as well, too.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, I think that recognized contamination rate over cases, you know, is contributing to the intracamular use at the end of the case of antibiotics. Topical application of betadine later in the case or at the end of the case. I know there was a study, I think it was international, that compared postoperative drops to one drop of betadine at the end of cataract surgery. And mm-hmm. certainly you have to be careful that the wound is sealed and tight if you're administering betadine in that setting. But the thought of cleaning things up, knowing that the surface wasn't as sterile at the end as the beginning, is the merit behind some of these modalities to limit risk.
Yeah, you know, the other thing is, too, particularly for cataract surgery, did you put a stitch in the incision or not?
Mm-hmm.
That may be something. I know when we kind of transitioned to clear cornea surgery, the rates may have gone up a little bit initially, just because those incisions maybe weren't as self-sealing as some of our others or others that we put a stitch in as well, too. So that's something to consider. Also, I find interesting is that they looked at the iris data from the American Academy of Ophthalmology, and that had a lower rate of endophthalmitis mm-hmm. than some of the rates that they found in their study here.
I thought it was interesting. There were lower rates with multiple different categories, and they thought, well, maybe the Medicare claims data is just a older age population, which are higher risk in general, and so maybe it's skewed a little versus iris, which is capturing a younger patient population.
Yeah, but the surgical population tends
to be older.
Yeah.
Exactly. Cataract surgery in general, or intraocular surgery in general, you'd think would be for an older patient population.
Yeah.
Let me come back to your first comment. You commented right off the bat that our practice has changed and intracameral use of antibiotics has become more standard of care, and certainly I think is identified as lowering risk. How universal is the use of intracameral antibiotics outside of cataract these days?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'll be honest with you. I don't think it's necessarily widely adopted.
Yeah.
I think the cataract surgeons have adopted it much more.
You know, as a pediatric ophthalmologist that does cataract, I think in the peds world, I think we're doing more and more across any, we're trying to go more dropless in kids mm-hmm. in light that we can't always trust the parents to getting drops in the children and whatever that means, whether it's, you know, Dextenza in the, or a steroid-like plug in places that would be help with the inflammatory, and number two, the use of intracameral whenever possible. I'm just curious because you're, you know, it's almost more the general rule than in seniors that I'm not aware of, but how often is a retina using? How often is glaucoma? And if not, why not? You know, if you do a MIGS, it's such a simple little procedure, but why not put the intracameral in, knowing the risks are comparable or higher than the rate of infection after cataract surgery? Mm-hmm. And if in cataract surgery we see that risk, so listeners can email us and let me know that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, tell us the
that
answer.
Outcome, but.
If your question for someone who doesn't do cataract surgery, just because you're doing intracamerals doesn't mean that it's a dropless surgery. The patients still have post-op drops. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. So I think most of us consider still in the United States the standard of care. So to still use, let's say, antibiotic drops mm-hmm. after cataract surgery. But some of my colleagues here at Mayo do not. Because when you think about it scientifically, the topical antibiotic drops that you're putting in for that week, a few days after surgery, probably aren't as efficacious as the intracameral antibiotics you mm-hmm. injected. So in Europe and some places, it's just the intracameral antibiotics. Right now, I think most of us, but not all, are still using topical drops.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, strabismus isn't included in this group, but in our strabismus patients commonly in children, I care more about the steroid than the antibiotic. And so in a child who typically doesn't get much of an inflammatory response, I put betadine down throughout the case, including before I close conge.
Mm.
And I think giving a child topical combination antibiotic steroid is just treating ourselves, not really preventing a scleritis or an endophthalmitis or a cellulitis after strabismus surgery. So I think that, you know, articles like this and others that are continuing to learn about how to modulate these risks using antibiotics strategically in surgery mm-hmm. certainly is lowering the risk and giving us flexibility postoperatively in terms of how we treat patients.
Yeah, and just, you know, some data I got from one of my colleagues, you know, our cataract endophthalmitis rate with antibiotics given intracamerally is about 1 in 8,000, which is, I think, 0.0125%, which is a fraction mm-hmm. of even some of the lower rates that we yep. see in these reported data.
It's great for counseling patients just in terms of their risk. Overall, your risk is exceptionally low in other procedures like corneal transplant or IOL exchange, secondary IOL, those things. Your risk is higher than normal. Still low, like you said, low and lower.
Yeah.
Still low, but just things to think about when our patients are stratifying risk for surgery.
Hey, one other question then in terms of practice. In the peds cases, we'll sometimes do bilateral cases, not typically where a lens is inserted, but an infantile cataract in a situation where the risk of general anesthesia twice needs to be respected just as much as the rare risk of a ocular complication. I've always been nervous about that when you're placing lenses in an eye because the decisions in postoperative care refractively often based on what happens to the first eye. But I do see and hear of articles on bilateral cases in adults for a cataract surgery. What's the sense on how safe it's become and how common that's performed? Because certainly endophthalmitis risks are part of the equation of whether you expose both eyes to risks at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I recently did a journal club on this with the residents. Looking at the rates, there's some studies that have come out that show very low rates of endophthalmitis. But I was recently also at a meeting amongst a huge room of general ophthalmologists, and someone gave a presentation on doing what they call bilateral sequential cataract surgery. And then they asked for a show of hands, how many ophthalmologists here would want that done? And it was just a handful. So just for me, I would probably not want it, but the data do support that it can be safe.
That's reasonable.
Particularly if you re-prep and drape, use new instruments, re-gown and glove.
Yep.
Kind of treating it as two completely separate procedures, just one right after another, as opposed to delayed.
Well, excellent discussion.
Yeah.
Shall we move on to our next article?
Sure.
Okay, let's do it. I have to admit, this one is just way over my head, and so I'm really glad you two are here to help explain this to me. This is the ophthalmology workforce projections in the United States 2020 to 2035.
This was in ophthalmology just recently.
Yep.
September, wasn't it?
Yep.
Of 23. Yeah.
Huge analysis of workforce supply and demand projections for the next 15 years or so, and utilizing some different database techniques, some micro simulation techniques that we have to estimate projected supply and projected demand in different scenarios for how many ophthalmologists or the whole eye care team that we're going to need over the next few years.
Amir, this means you can't retire.
That's what this means for both of you.
Well, you know, I think Eric and I are a similar vintage, but I think I was looking for reasons why I could retire when I read this article.
I understand your comment that it gets in the weeds over how the data was mined through the Department of Health and Human Services and the Health Resources and Services Administration. Just, it sounds like they used varying techniques, both surveys, current understanding of practices, to quantify FTE needs and state licensure data to assess current and future. I think before we get to the shortage in terms of patients, because let's first talk about providers. Number one is we can say that we all know the population's growing in age and that ballooning with the baby boomers, and this speaks to other volumes of patients that don't have access to care, that if we fix that, what a big problem we have.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just curious about when you look back, and I say this in light of when I joined a residency program too long ago, 25 years ago or so, there was a push for within GME to reduce the number of ophthalmology spots. So I joined an ophthalmology program that had previously had six residents, and then because of pressure went to five and then to four. That same program is now back up to five or trying to go more. But around 25 years ago, my sense is there was a squeeze or a thought that we were having too many spots. And now it's sort of we're going scrambling saying we don't have enough spots. So just your take on that or in history.
Yeah, no, Eric, similar thoughts because, there was talk politically that maybe we need to start retraining specialists to do general medicine, provide more primary care. Here at the Mayo Clinic, when I was a resident, we had six residents here, and now we're currently at four. I think looking back, we wish we didn't go back down to four and would like to have that full cadre of residents. So there was also a time where maybe the prediction was we're going to have too many eye care providers, when that really hasn't been borne out. I think the pendulum's kind of swung the other way.
And this article sort of speaks to aspects of that, that it talks about the turnover in ophthalmology workforce going back, I think, 95 to 2017 was, you know, they said ranged from 3% to 19%, but the sense that turnover and retiring we're not producing at a level that they are starting to retire. And so we're not replacing our current workforce in the level that we should. But I it's interesting that the people that are retiring now largely were trained in the season where we had a higher number of spots across the country. And those in practice now are largely, we're in that reduced model.
Right. So that's what was alarming to me, is that I thought that the increase in supply would still go up, that the slope would be positive, but just not quite enough. But it's not. It's going down. And that's absolutely shocking to me, that we're not even
keeping
pace at all. So that was kind of concerning. But before we get too much, let me read the results just quickly, some of the summary for those who don't have the paper in front of them. So basically, looking at these data, over the next 15 years, the total ophthalmology supply was projected to decrease by about 12% for FTE ophthalmologists. And then the demand was projected to increase by about 24% in terms of FTE ophthalmologists, representing a supply and demand mismatch of 30% workforce inadequacy. And they defined inadequacy as supply divided by demand. It was different in terms of rurality, and so that's a fun word to say, rurality, in terms of being in metro areas versus more rural areas. As you would expect, more rural areas face an even greater deficiency of care. And then they did two different scenarios. They had like a base rate scenario and then this increased access to care scenario. And so if they did it looking at the decreased barriers where patients would be able to get access, those who are currently are unable to get access, and there was decreased barriers to care, then the discrepancy increased even more. They're forecasting sizable shortages of ophthalmology supply. And this is really something I think we need to focus on in lots of ways. We talked about health policy and using advocacy and talking about specialties that are not so represented, like pediatric ophthalmology, where we have huge shortages, talking about increasing GME funding and GME supply so that we're training more ophthalmologists, utilizing tech and AI. There's so many different things we can do to fight this.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think the other thing that's interesting is, are more ophthalmologists working part-time? So, you know, some of the older generation might be more of the 1.0 FTEs. These days, maybe people aren't working 1.0. They want a better work-life balance, and ophthalmology is one of those fields that affords you that opportunity, and you can still do surgery and see patients and take call. So that might be interesting too.
You know, I thought that too, and I was really surprised, and I even underlined it. I thought, am I reading this wrong? There was an area that said, let me see if I can find it, that said that the amount of FTEs was much higher than the amount of providers. And that didn't make sense to me, because I would have expected...
Yeah, I thought it the other way around.
Here we go. Yeah, exactly. Here it is. The FTE supply is higher than the count of active physicians. And I thought the other way around, because you would think that there's more physicians, but less FTE. But
No, I think that's just their math. I read it as, in doing their calculations, they calculated it based on full-time FTEs in all of their calculations. So what it means is, if active physicians are working less than that... which we know that it is, then the numbers projected here are actually even higher than what the reality is.
Oh, I see.
That's how I read it.
Is
in their math.
Than the count of active physicians.
So they're saying we're having a shortage of 12% if everyone worked full FTE.
Oh.
And that's how I read the article, and maybe I could be misled there, but it certainly, no matter how you look at the numbers and the projections given, we aren't keeping pace to the volume of patients needed. One other caveat, as you summarized it, this article broke down in terms of which specialties in healthcare have the greatest disparity in adequacy of their needed volume. And sadly, you know, is projected, and here it goes out to 2035, that it would put ophthalmology at the second worst in medicine. Right now, we're at about the 18th of the difference.
Right.
But it certainly, with the baby boomers, with the volume, with the needs of the aging population and our current numbers, it's a concern coming.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think this is good data if you're trying to increase the size of your residency program.
Mm-hmm.
This is great data to show the need. The other thing this article points out, it also mentions optometrists also as eye care providers
mm-hmm.
as part of the team.
Mm-hmm.
That's another group that will be using some of the same data too.
Yep.
I think one of the things that, again, for a recent article, I thought they kind of just glanced over it at the end, just throwing up the tech. When really, I think that's going to be some of the key stuff for really screening large populations of people. So they mentioned here, you know, for example, they said the use of diabetic eye care has been correlated with ophthalmologist supply. Diabetic eye care in the future is probably going to be done through non-mitriatic photos being automatically read.
Mm-hmm.
And that way you're able to screen a high number of people, and then only people that truly need to see an eye care provider in person are going to need that appointment. So I think that may be one way to mitigate both the growing demand and the increasing shortage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this article, I agree with you, it sets the stage for meaningful concern for the numbers ahead, but doesn't give much for solutions.
Yeah.
It does present some paragraphs over the utilization of virtual technology. It talks about the critical role or the presence of adequate numbers of ophthalmic techs or support staff and how we use the resources we currently have in our systems of care now to maximize efficiency will become all the more important.
Yep. The other interesting thing is there have been some other good papers that have looked at supply and current needs and where we have those deficiencies and talking about the rural areas where we don't have enough representation for our patients. And the problem is that just increasing supply doesn't mean delivering supply to where it's needed. And what we found is when we have more people enter the workforce, they just go to the city.
Right.
And not, so they're still leaving the gap. So we end up having an oversupply in the city and an even bigger gap in the more rural areas.
Right.
And so that's something that's easy to overlook. Well, we just need to train more people so we have better access. Like actually, it doesn't help access. It gives us an over-access in the city. And those people who still have barriers, it doesn't change.
But that's really where some of these screening, like telehealth type objectives can
yes.
really help in rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
You have family practice office that has a camera there,
mm-hmm.
and they can get pictures of their diabetics' eyes or their patients on Plaquenil and other things, and then those can be read remotely somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that'll be one way of addressing access in rurality.
Rurality.
Yeah, I appreciate we serve in a state here in Minnesota that continues to be strategic about that. We've had studies to say how far away is everyone in the state away from an ophthalmologist mm-hmm. to provide care, and actually where our coverage is quite good. I think one memory is it was in the range of something like you can find an ophthalmologist as close as you can find a Starbucks. Now you can say there are parts in you know rural areas there's not a lot of Starbucks in places, but it was reasonable. But as we know across the country,
yeah.
there are some places that don't have that access in the same capacity. And I totally agree with you. I think the creative approach to virtual mm-hmm. screening will be a big piece going forward, and efficiency when they do come to offices, and that whether you know extension satellites or their bigger centers.
Yeah, and even something like retina, you know, macular degeneration, the leading cause of blindness in the Western world. I mean, that and glaucoma. I have a feeling like my colleagues, after obtaining all their imaging studies, it's very akin to radiology. That you kind of go in the room and just look and confirm what all the imaging studies have shown you.
Yeah.
So those two diseases in particular are very amenable to people getting testing somewhere
mm-hmm.
and then having interpretation done elsewhere.
Yeah, here at the Mayo Clinic, we've continued doing various quality efforts in clinical care that in terms of we're looking at glaucoma screening, as you're speaking to, you know, retina efforts, in particular Plaquenil screening mm-hmm. and creative use of resources to screen people to identify the ones that need care, and the rest can go back to their regular lives in terms of follow-up with an appropriate interval screening and not the comprehensive exams. Other thoughts?
Well, I think these data are so important in generating creative solutions, just like you said, and then also really speaking with our lawmakers. You know, I'm always thinking about this in an advocacy sense. We go to Mid-Year Forum, we travel to the Hill, we speak with our lawmakers. And some of this really does trickle down to recruiting people into ophthalmology and getting people to choose those specialties. Like I said, pediatric ophthalmology. One of the big barriers that we face is declining reimbursements. That's a huge issue for ophthalmology. Our reimbursement rates haven't even kept up with inflation. Extremely challenging to have enough reimbursement in pediatric ophthalmology, uveitis, neuro-ophthalmology to even make ends meet. And so our best and our brightest just aren't choosing those specialties. And so I think we need to speak with our lawmakers and show them these data. We need people to go into these specialties, and they need to have reimbursements that allow them to do that.
What you said highlights kind of some of the dichotomy within, let's say, ophthalmology, because ophthalmology, as a medical student, they'll tell you it's a competitive field. So so we have a lot of applicants who want to do ophthalmology. But once they start ophthalmology, there are some areas that people don't want to do. And I think part of it is to try to make those areas more appealing. Mm-hmm. Probably one of the biggest ways to make something more appealing is to provide more money. I think, Eric, you can speak about this. The Pediatric Ophthalmology Society is now paying for med students to do rotations in pediatric ophthalmology.
We were just talking about this.
We were.
It's so great.
And part of that's just exposure.
Yeah. I mean,
you go through a residency program, and different programs have different experiences. And getting an early exposure to a subspecialty that might be of interest, it's a very creative way to, before they even hit residency, give medical students an opportunity to see pediatric ophthalmology as attractive.
Yeah.
So. Anyone listening, encourage your best and brightest to choose ophthalmology.
There you go.
And don't be afraid to choose some of the subspecialties in ophthalmology that are in great need. Go work out in rurality.
Or set up your virtual clinic to help.
Or set up a virtual clinic. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Great articles. Learned a lot. This is wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you again for inviting me. And yeah, it's always nice to bounce ideas, because oftentimes I think that we just sit at home, we read the article by ourselves and wonder a little bit, but it's nice to have an interaction with other
Definitely.
People too. So,
yeah, thanks.
Thank you for being part of the experience again today, and we'll look forward to having you back again someday.
Oh, thank you. I'll see what I do in the third half of my day usually.
You can find all episodes of the Mayo Clinic Ophthalmology Podcast on our website.
Thank you for listening, and we definitely look forward to sharing more.